uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Solidarity City was established in April 2025 to serve workers and communities that have been harmed by the current administration. It was created by organizers using history as a roadmap that taught them how communities have survived economic crisis. And we have Dr. Niyana Koko, who will discuss the impact of the Trump administration on Black families. You do not want to miss this show. Stay tuned. Morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. Our first guest, and I'll only use her first name, Helen, had left her job at the U.S. Department of Labor to do more organizing activism, as she writes, quote, in this moment of encroaching authoritarianism, end quote. Helen has been organizing in D.C., although not exclusively, since 2017, with focuses on climate, abortion rights, Palestine, and anti-authoritarian protests. She's been living in D.C. since 2006, originally from New York and New Jersey. And she is one of the organizers of the Solidarity City in Washington, D.C. Helen, welcome to What's at Stake.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. The Trump administration and Elon Musk have orchestrated the firing of tens of thousands of government employees across federal agencies. They've dismantled federal programs and agencies and halted federal funds and financial assistance programs that people relied upon to survive. You recently resigned from your federal government job at the U.S. Department of Labor. What was it like working for the federal government in this political environment?
It was certainly stressful. Since January, we knew that federal workers would be under attack, but we didn't know how fierce it would be. Trump's Office of Management and Budget Chief Russell Vogt has said he wants to cause federal workers trauma. And that's exactly what they've tried to do. So you know when you go to your job that you could be fired any day. You could be forced to leave without even taking your items from your desk. Many people were forced to go back to the office even when there was no office space for them. And they had to make childcare arrangements, elder care arrangements on a last minute basis, which disproportionately harms people with caretaking responsibilities. So that means women largely. This administration has been called anti-woman, and here's another example of that. It's a very difficult environment to get any work done, especially when you don't know if your agency director could be fired at any time, whether your boss could be fired at any time, or whether your entire agency could be slashed illegally at any time, like USAID was.
And so, you know, I was trying to compare that to when I worked for the federal government, and I think I asked you before the program how this administration is navigating around the federal protections that the unions have put into place to protect mm-hmm. federal workers, as well as the Civil Service Protection Act. I mean, so how is the administration navigating around these protections for federal workers?
Well, to put it very bluntly, they just don't seem to care about the law. They don't seem to care about what courts say. They don't seem to care about what's written in statute. And so they kind of have this do it now and let the courts sort it out. We assume the Supreme Court will be on our side way of acting. And, you know, when you expect your adversary to follow the law, that's one thing, but these people don't care about the law. So it's very difficult to respond, right? When they don't even care, in the case of the deportations, what the Supreme Court is telling them to do. So that's my answer to how they're getting around it. They just don't care what the law says.
And so what about the internal, I mean, I hate to sort of dive into this a bit, but what about the internal mechanisms? Like you have the PIPs and the PAPs and if you know what that is, you know, you have these structures in the federal government that are at least supposed to give federal workers an opportunity to try to correct, if that's the correct word, something that supposedly the supervisors have said that they've done. Mm-hmm. But in this situation, is the order to fire a federal employee coming above the supervisor's head, which means that it's not really work-related. It's something that's not work-related. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. We've had these incidents, many of them, where federal workers are being fired allegedly for performance reasons, and they can point to their years of excellent or outstanding performance reviews. So that's clearly not the case. DOGE plays a big role. You have these 20-year-old kids assigned by Elon Musk to just come into agencies and slash and burn, even though they've never worked in government and they have no idea what they're doing. And one of the ways this administration acts is by moving very, very quickly before federal workers, unions, et cetera, can respond. And that makes it very difficult to respond effectively. But I will say we've had some great examples of people in federal government standing up and saying, no, this is wrong. I will not fire my direct report for performance reasons when they perform perfectly well. I will not hand over data to a bunch of unvetted 20-somethings from Silicon Valley. And I just want to commend those federal workers for standing up for the American people.
So you left your federal job and now you're helping to organize Solidarity Cities. And we'd like for you to talk about what that is. But it's also known as Muskville.
Yes, and that was on purpose.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm fascinated that you and your colleagues reached back in history and discovered not a similar situation, but at least an interesting situation, and designed Solidarity City from the blueprint of history. So first of all, let's talk about Solidarity City. What is Solidarity City?
So we are an installation that is taking place outside Union Station in downtown DC. On Columbus Plaza. We just launched on Sunday and we expect to go about 3 weeks. It is an organizing space. It is a community space. We are trying to bring people together. We have programming throughout the 3 weeks lined up, but if anyone listening would like to propose more programming, we would welcome your ideas. There's a form at solidaritycity.org that you can fill out, and that's also where you can get the schedule for the day. So far, people have been coming by for our evening programs, which feature local organizations talking about the work they do, features activists, features cultural performances. So we have musicians, we have DJs. And then during the day, we have skills building workshops, we have political education, we have trainings, we have services for job searchers, including those job searchers who were illegally fired by this administration. So it's a way for people to connect. It's a way for people to get the services they need that aren't being provided by the government. It's a demonstration of mutual aid and solidarity, both with local communities and with global communities. And I don't know what it'll turn into, but I hope that more people will come down and it'll just keep getting bigger.
So initially, this experiment is for like 3 weeks. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what we expect.
Right. And then you're going to determine whether or not you're going to continue this program once you understand or see whether or not the community responds to what you're doing now.
Yeah, I think it's open-ended, and maybe other cities will be inspired and other solidarity cities will pop up across the country. Maybe it'll turn into something else. Maybe people will be inspired and join the organizations that they learn about through Solidarity City. As I said, it's open-ended. We really don't know.
Okay. I love the experimental quality of this project. And I love the fact that a former federal government worker has sort of reached outside of herself to sort of bring, you know, to create this kind of community. And, you know, BACC, the group that I work with, will certainly participate. And we'd love to come and give a talk about the cemetery in Bethesda. So Solidarity City will build on the legacy of Hoovervilles.
Right.
Now, I had never, you know, I'm a historian, a political scientist, whatever. And I had never heard of Hoovervilles. So can you tell us what is the background of the history behind Hoovervilles?
I'm not a historian, so I hope I do justice to the topic. But in the Great Depression, shanty towns popped up all over the country in response to the economic crisis. And the name Hooverville was a jab at the president at the time, Herbert Hoover, who many blamed for the crisis. And similarly, the nickname for Solidarity City is Muskville, because we blame, you know, the crisis, the economic crisis affected families before the Trump-Musk administration took place, but they are absolutely exacerbating it. The Trump administration and Elon Musk and Doge in particular, especially in the DC area, because they are firing all these local federal workers, but also by slashing services, by making Social Security harder to obtain, and by going into that system and, you know, people aren't able to get their checks on time. We're hearing complaints about that. They're cutting the Department of Education. They're cutting the Department of Health and Human Services. The result is and is going to be a worsening of our lives, you know, when we don't have these services that we've relied on. And so the situation is very, very similar to the one in the Great Depression. And that's why we think Muskville is an appropriate nickname for Solidarity City. We want to call out specifically what this administration is doing to make people's lives worse.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hearing from the people who are showing up at Solidarity City? I mean, what kinds of stories are you hearing from them?
We're hearing stories from immigrants about how scared they are of ICE coming for family members and community members. We are hearing from illegally fired federal workers about the important work that they were doing. I've been meeting a ton of fired federal workers, and I just can't believe the types of work that they were doing. We have CDC, Centers for Disease Control, NIH, National Institutes of Health, Social Security Administration. I mean, these are services and agencies that Americans want that are very popular. And Elon Musk and Doge are coming in and just slashing and burning with no idea what they're doing. And, you know, we have federal workers and former federal workers speaking out and people who rely on these services speaking out. But I'm hoping that Solidarity City can sort of be a focus for drawing attention to what's happening and a way for more people to come together and organize together to fight back against what this administration is doing.
You know, I love the vision statement that I found on your website. I wanted to share it with our audience. It goes like this. They want to isolate us and we'll build community. They want to fire us. We'll work for each other. They want to slash education. We'll teach and learn from each other. They want to keep funding genocide and deportation. will keep fighting for people and the planet. They're claiming scarcity. We're sharing abundance.
I love that you brought that up. Thank you, because we are trying to build the world that we want to live in and counter the very dark vision of the Trump-Musk administration, right? Which is all about scarcity and othering and isolation. And we're saying, no, there's enough for everyone if we just share resources, if we take some of the resources away from billionaires and spread the love a little bit. You know, we can provide mutual aid. We can share with all of the communities around us. Sorry, my dog just came up to me and started demanding cuddles. Speaking of love and community. So thank you for reading that statement.
And mutual aid, when you talk about mutual aid, are you talking about providing, you know, substance like food, water? I mean, when you talk about mutual aid, what do you mean by that?
There is a component of that. Unfortunately, we don't have the funding to provide meals for people. But, you know, there are plenty of unhoused people in the Union Station area, and we welcome them and we provide food and water when we have it. Absolutely. Anyone, it's an open area. Anyone is welcome to come by. And to me, the mutual aid aspect of it is more about the skills that we share, the trainings that we provide. So we welcome job searchers, as I mentioned, and we provide them with services. We have we will have jobs, rather service fairs, Fridays and Saturdays, and people are welcome to come and learn about how they can sign up for unemployment insurance, what other services the city provides or that haven't been cut by Trump and Musk yet. And people are volunteering their time, right? Mm-hmm. Like we can't do this without many, many, many unpaid volunteers. And so they are taking time off of their jobs or away from their families, whether they're providing 40 hours a week of service or just an hour a week, you know, taking a volunteer shift. We deeply appreciate all of those volunteers, and we encourage listeners to come volunteer. You can sign up on the website.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you give us an example of the kind of programming? Because it's on your website. So can you give us an example? For example, today, do you have programming that's offered today that our listeners could tap into?
Definitely. I am having trouble remembering what exactly is on the docket for today. I know I will be down there volunteering, but I will just call out a couple of things I know have happened or are happening this week. Mm-hmm. One session that I am actually running, I believe tomorrow, is a job interview prep. So I'm going to be job searching at some point. Lots of other people are out there job searching, and we're going to basically interview each other and practice for when we have to interview for real. We have political education on, I'm trying to think of some examples. I would love to have one on the history of Hoovervilles and how that ties into what we're doing today. So if anybody is a Hooverville expert, please fill out the programming proposal and we would love to get you on the calendar. But in the evenings, as I mentioned, we have local organizations come and talk about the work they do. So we'll have local unions talking about labor fights in the area. And then we have cultural performances. We have spoken word artists. We have singers. Oh, we have amazing singers to kick off all of our nightly performances. We have DJs. And so there's a whole range of programming depending on what people from the community are willing to provide. And when you look on the schedule on our website, you will see so many different things. You can really pick what you're interested in and come for that.
So you do have the quote unquote homeless community engaged in this process as well, I assume. Or do you? I don't know if there's an interconnection between, you know, the workers who have been disenfranchised and the homeless population. How are these two communities coming together?
Well, it's interesting because everyone in America is just one bad financial crisis away from being homeless, right? Like we don't have guaranteed housing, we don't have guaranteed healthcare. And that's one of the reasons I think these federal workers are so scared about losing their jobs, because A missed paycheck can mean a missed mortgage payment, and then you and your family are out on the street. We have very few protections against that, right? And so that's the connection in my mind. And as far as the community around Union Station that lives there that doesn't have permanent housing, we welcome them into our tents. We try to, you know, make sure that they have a place to rest, that they can get some food and water, that they can participate in any programming. There are a lot of folks who travel through Union Station, maybe on the way from other cities, maybe they don't have a permanent place to live. And I've spoken to a few people like that, and they like everyone else are curious, like, what is this thing? What is Solidarity City? What are you doing? And we've had some great conversations where we hear about their stories and how they have responded to the economic crisis. And we try to connect them to services if we can.
Mm-hmm. And so you talked about the union, at least you mentioned the union. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the federal workers are generally covered by AFGE and NTEU unions. Have you had any relationship or outreach to the two unions that support federal workers? And
yes.
Mm-hmm. Because that's obviously a place to get volunteers too. So
yes, yeah. Definitely. And I should shout out the Federal Unionist Network, which is a group I'm part of. It's this new group that focuses, it's cross-union. So we have AFGE folks, we have NIFE folks, we have NTEU, and there are actually other unions that represent both private and public sector workers that are also that cover federal workers. And they are definitely a part of our fight. I've been very lucky to make, I was an AFGE Local 12 member, and I've been very lucky to connect with both folks in my local and outside my local. And I think in this moment where we're under attack, people are especially eager to make those connections and figure out how we can work together across unions, across federal agencies. There's been a lot of cross-union, cross-agency cooperation, you know, conversations about like what's happening at your agency. This is what's happening at ours. How did you respond to this situation? This is how we responded, and it was effective or it wasn't effective. The Federal Unionist Network has been great at that. And I think, you know, if society is able to overcome this threat of authoritarianism, it will be in large part because of unions and union members.
Is there a threat of violence? I mean, do you sense that there could be, or a threat of violence against workers, particularly not necessarily former federal workers, but, you know, we talk about this, how marginalized and traumatized workers are at this moment. And generally, you know, when we look at other workers' movements, there's always been this sort of tinge of violence attached to it. I haven't felt that at this point, but, you know, I'm not really sort of on the inside anymore. Is there any sense that people are also nervous about their physical safety as well as their economic safety?
What comes to mind is workers from FEMA who, because of right-wing misinformation, they go out to areas that have been stricken by extreme climate events, and then they are met with threats. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking of North Carolina after the recent hurricanes. At least in organizing Solidarity City, we haven't felt any threats of violence. It's actually been a very child-friendly, supportive space. Yesterday I was down there, there was music playing, there were families laughing. It was very peaceful and lovely. But you never know what repressive authoritarian regimes do. Maybe we haven't gotten to that point, but I don't think it's off the table, depending on what happens. There are all sorts of threats coming down from the Trump administration about the Insurrection Act and other things. And that's one reason I think it's important to remain very peaceful as an opposition movement, because you don't want, the government has all the tools of violence, and You don't want them to come after you with those tools. But so far things have looked relatively okay. Fingers crossed.
So is the Solidarity City an encampment? I mean, are you actually camped out in front of Union Station?
No, we are not. Nobody's sleeping there. We do have security guards overnight watching the gear because we have, you know, a sound system, a stage, things like that. But nobody's sleeping there.
Okay. And so I know we talked a little bit about Occupy yesterday. Mm-hmm. It's not close. It's not like Occupy, which did, in fact, trigger government retaliation and government action against the Occupy movement. But at least with Solidarity City at this point, you've not had any kind of adverse government impact or reaction to Solidarity City.
We have not, to be fair. We're only 3 or 4 days in, but there are many differences between Solidarity City and Occupy. I sure hope we don't face government repression.
Yeah, exactly. So what are some of the, what does Solidarity City need from the community at this point?
Thank you for asking. Your dream list. Yeah, well, we really need volunteers because we've had, you know, there are a few dozen core organizers that have been doing the bulk of the planning and execution, but it's going to be unsustainable without volunteers from the community. And we've already had amazing volunteers sign up, but we need more. We need folks to staff the welcome tent. We need folks to help with logistics. If there's anyone who can help, you know, figure out how to get food there, that would be amazing. And then we have an amazing list of programs for the first week, but the second and third weeks are more open. So if you have a proposal for some political education you'd like to see, or a training you'd like to do, or if you have a direct service that you can provide, there are forms on our website. The volunteer form is also on our website, as well as the schedule of events. So sign up, fill out a proposal form. We would love more community engagement with all of those things. And then just come by, find something you're interested in and come by.
So what is a good time to stop by Solidarity City?
Because a lot of people work during the day, I think most people come by for our evening events. And that's when we have community organizations sharing about what they do. That's when we have music. That's when we have the most people. But really, it depends what you're interested in. If you want to take a free yoga class, come in the morning when we do yoga and other physical activities. If you're interested in getting educated about a topic, come during that time slot. It's really up to you. The other thing I'd say is please tell your friends and community members about this. Again, we want to grow it as big as possible.
What is your website address again?
SolidarityCity.org.
You want to repeat that again?
SolidarityCity.org. Check it out. So, it's a beautiful website.
So it is very, very colorful, actually. So how is that the best way to reach you? Is through your website?
Yes.
Okay, right.
We are also on social media, I should say, Instagram at SolidarityCityDC. And that is the Blue Sky account as well, SolidarityCityDC.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed meeting you, and you know, this kind of volunteer grassroots organization seems to me like exactly what our community needs to feel empowered again after feeling like someone has stuck a needle inside.
Exactly, that's one of the things we're trying to do: bring people together and make them feel empowered. So, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, and we'll be in touch. So thank you very much. Good. Well, we'll take a short break for community announcements.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of April 21st, 2025. Wednesday, April 23rd is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur Study Group Session, a global perspective on policing, community safety, and security from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info and registration is requested on globalperspectiveonpolicing.eventbrite.com. Thursday, April 24th, the Institute for Policy Studies invites you to the Poetry and Book Event, 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, a pathway toward healing and reconciliation at the Tacoma Busboys and Poets from 6 to 8 p.m. More info and RSVP is requested on ips-dc.org/events. On Friday, April 25th, from 4 to 8 p.m., the Palestinian Youth Movement will hold a protest to honor and take heed to a global day of action for Gaza. This will take place at the State Department, 2201 C Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info can be found on Instagram at DMVPYM. On Saturday, April 26th, from 2 to 3:30 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C., there will be a happy, nappy storytelling in the time of the drums children's book reading with Mama Busena and Alafia. Finally, on Sunday, April 27th from 7 to 9, also at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, there will be a special musical performance by Joseph Fanfan Lewis. More info can be found on Sankofa.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Daya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at wpfwfm.org.
Welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Our next guest is Dr. Niyana Coco. Good morning, Dr. Coco.
Top of the day. How is your spirit?
Excellent. Thank you so much. I'm so excited about discussing the state of the Black family, particularly during this era. And we welcome others, if you like, to call into the studio and join the conversation at 202-588-0893. But first, before we start, a brief bio. Dr. Niyana Coco was educated in the HBCU system. He received his Bachelor of Science degree from North Carolina A&T State University in psychology with a minor in biology. He received a master's degree at Fisk University and Meharry Medical College, joint program in clinical psychology. And he received a doctorate degree in psychobiology, neuropsychology at Howard University. He's authored two books anchored in social neuroscience, Reality Check, A Manual for the Human
Octahedron.
Thank you. And The Mystery of Melanin and the Awakening, OMG, The President is Black. Completion of his third book on ancient perspectives and crossing over is projected for release in 2025. And he's a professor at a local university. I just wanted to mention that you're also speaking this Friday at the UNIA Freedom Friday Forum on Stabilizing Health and Identity in Urban Families. You'll discuss how to fortify, nurture, and empower the families of melanin-dominant humans to better navigate the incessant pathology of America's dehumanizing governance. And you can find the link to the lecture at www.facebook.com/UNIA Division 330. So let's talk about the Black family, or what you call the melanin dominant family. Do you define the Black family as the most important institution responsible for the survival of Black people in America? Or is there another institution that you would consider equally as important?
Well, thank you for the question. Before I continue to speak, I want to give a shout out to Dr. Miriam Kroc, C-R-O-A-K, because she is the reason why we're able to talk in this arena. She developed a platform for Zoom, WebEx. She did all of that research as a sister of color. And she's an engineer. And I just want you to know she was inspired to develop this communication network after Katrina. So shout out to Dr. Marion, C-R-O-A-K. Now, answering your question, of course, the foundation of, I refer to, quote unquote, people identified as Black as melanin dominant humans, because we oftentimes find ourselves repeating what we've been told. And melanin dominant humans on the planet are literally the people that Dr. Francis Quest Wilson would always talk about. So Black and white, that's some stuff that Europeans just throw around to polarize different, you know, arenas of ignorance about the human family. I want to be clear about that. So in terms of importance, absolutely, the crown jewel of any civilization and community is the family. And the family of melanin dominant people, AKA Black folk, is literally tied to their spiritual connectedness. And their spiritual connectedness is usually embedded in structures or organizations tied to what we refer to as churches. So the Black family, not only is the Black family the foundation of the stabilization of what we recognize as quote unquote civilization, Black families or melanin dominant humans are the foundation of the fabric of humanity, period. So when we fail to notice how critically important it is to have an intact family unit to raise our children and spread out into the community, we put ourselves at risk. So the bottom line is, there's nothing more important on stabilizing the planet than the stability of the families of melanin-dominant humans. And that does not just restrict itself to so-called Black people. That's the brown people, the red people, all of the people that do not classify themselves as quote-unquote so-called white.
So for you, the church and the family, I mean, the spiritual foundation and the family, these two institutions become sort of the engine of that allows the family, that allows this community to move forward into the next crisis or into the next situation that they find themselves in. It is the institution that provides the structure to allow mobility, flexibility, and the ability to navigate challenges in society.
Absolutely. And a church can be interchanged with mosque. The church can be interchanged with synagogues, because contrary to popular belief, there are a lot of melanin-dominant humans, original quote-unquote slash Hebrew Israelite Jews that are people of color. So when I say church, I'm talking about the structure, the institution, because you're not able to do anything on any planet if you don't have an institution and a structure. And you can give praise to and Malcolm for that and Gandhi for that. But the bottom line is, you must have a unit and an organization. Matter of fact, the Urban League and the NAACP would be less than known in history if it wasn't for quote unquote organizations, institutions that we refer to as the church.
Right. So when we're thinking about, we just had, you know, an interview a few minutes ago where we're talking about, in many ways, the disintegration of structures in society. Because you know, people relied on jobs and employment as a way of supporting the family. And now you have a situation where the government is actually unemploying federal workers, unemploying other workers who are involved in or are attached to the federal workplace, like consultants and contractors who work for the federal government. And so you've got this, in many ways, sort of a crisis going on, societal crisis. And because of that, there's this pressure on the Black family that I think is not, certainly not unique, but certainly at a very difficult place right now. So can you give us a compare and contrast, perhaps, between the Black family under, for example, the Biden administration, if that's a good example, as opposed to what we just heard about with Helen under the Trump administration? Can you compare and contrast those two situations?
As a matter of fact, I will evoke a reality. Down in Alabama, one of the things that the Biden administration actually raised the flag to notice was the situation that involved a number of people that were around what they referred to as the Black Belt in Alabama. They had a problem with fundamental hygiene of the households related to the sewage system. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because this is a specific trigger and a catalyst that relates specifically to melanin-dominant humans, disenfranchised people of color, quote-unquote, Black people. Biden actually did take a position to say that they needed to do better. They need to actively engage in doing some things relating to that. And I'm only using that as a frame of reference because it's a hallmark issue. It is still going on, and it has not basically been addressed. In that same vein, when you talk about the current administration would be more synonymous to what the First Nation people or Sky people, quote unquote, so-called classic Native Americans, referred to as the one who pretends to be the great eagle. And the great eagle, as you know, eagles don't fly anywhere without the ability to use both wings. And the wing of the Democratic Party has historically been a wing that you could associate with, I think you might refer to it as what? These call it the left or the right, all right? But the point that I'm making is on the other side of the bird, you have another wing. And that wing would represent the Republicans. But the point is those two wings are attached to the same bird. And the U.S. government has always, unfortunately, either subtly, discreetly, behind closed doors, minimized doing justice to melanin-dominant people. Period. That's her signature. That's what happens when you have a corporation. The main overt visible difference is with the current administration is overt in your face. It's like old school Southern classic overt racism. Conversely, previous administrations were a little bit like Northern, upper, like, let's say, Connecticut. Boston, well, you can't use them because they were like the people in the South. But the point that I'm making is one group, they were literally not discreet with their acts of systematic racism. And the other group were a little bit more discreet and manipulative and subtle with their acts of racism. So let's be candid and clear. This government operates out of a corporate enterprise, which is primarily concerned with stock. And stock has to do with dollars and cents. That's C-E-N-T-S. Not sense, all right, related to S-E-N-S-E, because this country has never demonstrated any overt, consistent compassion and sensitivity to melanin-dominant people in this country, be they First Nation people, whom you will no longer see on the metros and major cities because they have been exterminated, and prior to us moving into the late 80s and early 90s, melanin-dominant people, i.e. Black so-called African-Americans, were the largest minority. And now Black melanin-dominant people are behind your Latino Chicano brothers and sisters. Black people make up probably about 12.5 to 13% of the U.S. population, whereas your Latino Hispanic brothers and sisters make up about 19 to 21%. So no matter how you cut it, the governance of this country has always marginalized melanin-dominant people.
So how has mass incarceration, lack of Black male leadership, within the family and high poverty levels impacted the organic structure of the Black family? How has those systems impacted?
When you really get down to it, they used to have a language of they put in place like don't check the box. And now men of color that have been incarcerated, they might refer to them as returning citizens or returning to societies as opposed to referring to them as convicts, all right? It has always impacted melanin-dominant people. When you remove the men from an environment, you create an atmosphere of subtle nuances of hostility, because if the men are gone, there are no adult males available to help the young males learn how to navigate society and socialize in society. Probably about 3 decades ago, maybe 2.5 decades ago, National Geographic did an observation and study with the bull elephants in continental Africa. And they realized that when all of those people that would come in and kill the bull elephants to take their tusks and take their elephant hides, do all types of things, the adult male elephants that would give guidance to the young adolescent elephants were gone. And the adolescent elephants did exactly what you see happening today. They started forming gangs. They became rowdy. They became completely disrespectful for all of the elements in the great circle of life that they highlight in the quote unquote Lion King. So when you don't have adult mature males around to give guidance to young adolescent males, you create a toxic environment because those young men are wondering where their biological fathers are, while their mothers are unfortunately oftentimes finding themselves trying to, you know, get through life. And they may have relationship A and B or C. And the young males are angry that it's another guy interacting with their mother. And their mother does not know how to basically engage them in the ways of men because she's not a man. And it doesn't matter to me what people say about my grandmother did this, my grandmother did that. But your grandmother was wise enough to say, I'm going to expose you to some men that may be deacons in the church, or men that may be upstanding men, to be around you, because grandmothers, those era and that era, were wise enough to know that that young male child needed the company of a male that could give him some guidance. But today we don't have that because the men are incarcerated. And as a result of the incarceration, they come back out and they become marginally employable citizens in society. And that creates a schism in the community. It pisses off the women. It creates unnecessary toxic relationships because people don't know how to handle this. Because they are not accustomed to, it's something that they do to destabilize the community as you fragment the family.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of, you know, also think about this issue of destabilization, because that's also another theme that we heard from the first interview, is the destabilization of society. But from a psychological perspective, then how do we, you talked about our grandmothers and how they sort of, you know, intentionally expose young Black boys, if there wasn't one in the home, to someone that they trusted in the community. But some of those structures don't exist anymore that our grandmothers relied on. Just because we've migrated from, you know, from our home base to another city for employment or for education. So from a psychological perspective, how do we protect ourselves and our families against the structural effects of white supremacy? I mean, as a psychologist, you know, provide some guidance to us. I mean, how do we protect our hearts? How do we protect, you know, our ability to navigate a very complex and often hostile society?
A foundation to anyone or any species' ability to navigate any ecosystem or environment, and we know the systems that we live in today in urban environments are basically, unfortunately, oftentimes barely habitable environments, which means that they are so toxic and so compromised that it's difficult for people to figure out how to, you know, acquire the resources that they need. So critical to that is identity. When you do not know who you are, you will roam around aimlessly, connecting to whatever makes you feel good for a moment. And identity is tied to family. In this society, when you brought up the industrial prison complex, when you don't have men around, and it's a difference between a male and a man, all right? A male is just a biological manifestation of someone that's probably able to procreate or produce offspring. Men have consciousness, okay? Men are aware that they are not an adolescent. Men are aware that they do not do the things that little boys do, all right? Men understand that they could not exist if it was not for the divinity of women. That's one of the reasons why the first phoneme in the word woman, woe, is woe, i.e. for woman, i.e. relating to womb and creativity, and men come from that. So conscious men realize the divinity of womanhood, and they respect that. And so when you put men in an environment that sort of conjures confusion about their identity as a man, they come back out into a society not being able to have gainful employment, oftentimes being marginalized in terms of their masculinity, So they are completely lost. So when you don't have a sense of identity, it's no way in the world you can teach by example, because you don't know who you are. And if you don't know who you are, you don't know what to eat. And if you don't know what to eat, you will basically put things in your face to create the illusion of satiety while it confuses the entire quote unquote human biome, which means you will do dumb crap on a regular basis. And putting things in your body includes everything from too much ganja, too much alcohol, too much junk food. All those types of things will degrade your sense of identity. And frankly, from a neuroscientist point of view, all of those things inadvertently contribute to a variety of neuroinflammatory diseases in the central nervous system, the brain in particular, that will keep you from being able to learn how to think and navigate what's in the environment. And built into that, as I made a reference to the church, there were no churches that existed that did not have a choir, that did not have music. So when you lose your voice, you lose your sense of your song. And when you lose your song, you have no way to resonate your sense of identity. And if you don't have a sense of identity, you're going to respond to whatever you find on social networks and social media. And the average human today under the age of 16 has the attention span of a sneeze.
Wow. So let's talk about brain fog. And let's talk about food deserts, because, how do we create, like with the sanctuary city, where you have a physical manifestation, even though it may be temporary, but at least you have people organizing centers where people can go and learn about employment in terms of how to find another job, learn about, environmental issues, or learn about, taking care of health issues. How do we create those kinds of systems so that people can attach themselves to an identity if that wasn't an organic part of their growing up? And how do we perhaps begin to create, I don't want to say a sanctuary city, but structures in our community that provide similar functions as a family, if the family is not available to a large segment of our population?
Well, you heard me say it several times, the church, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, you have mega churches. There are mega churches around today. And if you go in and you don't have any silent money or paper money, they have an ATM machine somewhere nearby where you can get it. And you can't get money out of ATM machine if you don't have a piece of plastic to get into the ATM machine. But my point that I like to make is the church. When you take an organization like the NAACP, the Urban League, the Black Bar Association, the Association of Black Social Workers, the Association of Black Psychologists, you really need to realize that organizations are critical to doing anything. You're not able to do anything. And as you're talking about the state of affairs today, people need to open their eyes and stop waiting for MSNBC, CNN News to give them an idea of what's going on. There was a book that was just dropped a day ago, and I actually have it. I have a copy of it. It was written by David A. Graham from The Atlantic, and the name of the book is The Project, How Project 25 is Reshaping America's Release. How Project 25 is Shaping America. That's the title of it. It's by Random House, all right? It was just released the 22nd of April, 2025. Why am I telling you that? It's because you made a comment about what's happening with the current governance of the United States of America relating to the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Black Lives Matter Plaza. The Heritage Foundation literally set the stage for, and they've been around for 50 years plus, to design a four-pronged platform program with all of these policies that you see popping up that you think are coming from the current occupant. These things are already in place. As a matter of fact, the person that brought it to people's attention the first time was Taraji. I don't know what Taraji's last name is, but the entertainer, the sister Taraji, she's the one that sounded the alert when she was talking at the, it was an event, a gala event that was happening probably in 2024 about folk needed to read or to be exposed to it. And the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Black Lives Matter Plaza, basically said, I don't know anything about it. But if you take a look in David Graham's book, you will see what that person referenced at Sanctuary City. All those things were laid out in that book.
Mm-hmm. And so we only have one more minute left, and I wanted to make sure that our listeners know that you're speaking this Friday at the UNIA Freedom Friday Forum on Stabilizing Health and Identity in Urban Families. And you can find the link to your lecture at www.facebook.com/UNIA Division 330. We have 1 minute. Would you like to provide a closing? We have 30 seconds, obviously. Would you like to provide a very quick summation of your presentation today?
Identity matters. Who you are is critical to where you will be going. Thank you for allowing me to be on the platform. And again, I want to give a shout out to Dr. Marion Kroc, because we wouldn't even have Zoom and WebEx if it wasn't for that sister's research as an engineer.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge on this issue. I'd like to this has been incredible conversation today. So thank you so much. Thanks to all of our guests, Dr. Coco and Helen of Solidarity City. Thanks to executive producer, Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. I'm Marcia Coleman Adebayo. Have a wonderful day.
In commemoration of International Jazz Day, Friends of the Congo, Africa World Now Project, WPFW, and the Institute of Musical Traditions presents an evening examining jazz, espionage, and colonialism in Africa with a free screening of Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat on Wednesday, April 30, 6:30 p.m. at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street Northwest, steps away from the Tacoma Park Metro. The evening concludes with a panel discussion. Seating is limited, so registration is required. Details at Eventbrite and then searching Friends of the Congo. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, will feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Full schedule found on WPFWFM.org.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
And this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW is celebrating its 48th year, April 25th, 6:30 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds.
Vocalist Navasha Dea will perform, and James Funk will be on the ones and twos.
Longtime programmer Vaughn Martin, artivist Ayanna Gregory, and civil rights activist Dr. Joyce Ladner and Latoisha Brown, all of them will be honored that night.
Zain El Amin and Esther Iverum will share poetry.
It'll be an evening of community, music, poetry, and dancing with the WPFW family.
Tony Carr, Bill Wax, Kamal Harris, Craig Williams, Roach and Martine Brown, Tim Masters,
Violetta Diamond, Joni Eisenberg, Kim Bay, Verna Avery Brown, Ida Campbell, just to name a few of the programmers who will be hosting tables.
Details at WPFWFM.org.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and